You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
On Brand is brought to you by the Brand Driven Digital Event Series, featuring Digital Strategy Bootcamp. This day-long, intensive, and interactive workshop helps you ground your digital marketing with a solid strategy that you can share with your team. Learn more and register now at branddrivenbootcamp.com.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? Today's guest is Tamsin Webster. Tamsin specializes in how to tell the right story to the right people at the right time. As the Senior Vice President for Executive Communications at Oradium, a message consultancy, Tamsin is responsible for helping brands and individuals tell their stories day to day to drive business results. As the executive producer of TEDx Cambridge, she also selects and coaches speakers for the TEDx stage. Tamsin is the mother of two boys who regularly challenges what she thinks she knows about communication, a retired Weight Watchers leader, and a midlife marathoner. She's also delighted to be Tom Webster's other half. Tamsin, welcome to On Brand.
Well, thank you, Nick. Happy to be here.
Now, that is the official bio that one can find at the worldwide computer web. But what does that not tell the world about Tamsin Webster?
Well, it doesn't tell the world about my complete lack of sense of humor, my inimitable desire for ice cream at all times, and the fact that, you know what, I just have a really good time doing my job and living my life. But maybe that does come through.
I was going to say, I think you're also negating point one about your lack of sense of humor.
Well, you know, when you are the delighted other half of Tom Webster, then one can sometimes question that. Though I do make him laugh regularly, so
I
sell myself short.
You each have humor as dry as the wonderful martinis that you could find at the Webster household.
Yes, we do have those. That's probably also not in my bio. My deep affection for Manhattans.
Nice, nice, nice. Well, I was am fortunate enough to be a guest here on Mr. Tom Webster's Friday Five that we're actually going to record tomorrow. But that makes me think of the Scott Monty episode that I just listened to, where they were enjoying. Forget what the beverage of choice was.
It was a martini.
Absolutely. It was a martini. There we go. But that sounded like much more fun. And I also thought, that's how you record a podcast. You know, here we are over Skype. And, you know, at best, I've got a cup of coffee and water. But
yeah, I've got tea. Yeah, I think the martini is a much better way to go.
I know.
It's hard to justify at 10 o'clock in the morning. So.
It is. And we're not quite enough into the holidays yet where that's something that that is easy to dive into.
We could make a case for eggnog.
I think so. Okay, quick eggnog story. You know, it's the pile of people on the couch this morning, you know, with the kids and my daughter. I wake up to, because I'd kind of gone back to sleep on the couch, and I wake up to my feet are wet.
Oh, no.
And my daughter, my seven-year-old, has spilled the beverage that she has. And I'm like, what is this? She said, I spilled milk. And then I'm like, I'll go clean it up. And then I'm taking off my now wet sock. And I give it a smell. And I said, is this milk or is this eggnog? And she says sheepishly, eggnog? So I guess,
but it's a milk-like product, though. Dad, come on!
It is, and I guess the moral of the story is it's never too early for eggnog. So
hopefully, it wasn't like spiked eggnog, was it? Like legit?
No.
Okay, I was gonna say, what's your seven-year-old doing with eggnog?
I was gonna say, yeah, if she'd gotten into that, you know, it's just like,
That would explain the nap on the couch, though, I'd have to say.
It would. It would explain a lot. A great many things would be explained by the presence of spiked eggnog. So I want to welcome you again to our new on-brand podcast here. And just in reading your bio, and I guess some of the things, you know, that might be worth working in there as well. Prior to being at Oradium, you were on the agency side of things. I mean, I think that, you know, from agency work to the communications, consulting, message training that you're doing now, you know, you've worked on brand building from a lot of different angles. So at the risk of asking a somewhat nebulous kickoff question, what does branding mean to you?
Well, it's as you have already guessed at, it's a many faceted thing. When I'm working with companies on their brands and their messages, for me, branding is about clarifying and articulating the thing that gives the brand power. And I think that's the best way to put it, because for me, a brand doesn't exist solely within an organization. It is the sum total of the brand's touch points with its customers. That's the brand that counts. You can't get there without figuring out what you want it to be for the brand side. But I really think it is about articulating that source of market power.
That was like really well said for, you know, with asking such a big wide open leadoff question, there should be some sort of golden branding award for that's a really good textbook description of,
extra points for difficulty.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but you covered a lot of things too. I mean, obviously, and I think that, you know, whether you're talking about building your brand in any way or speaking, you are talking about, you know, building that position of power. Do you find that there are people that don't even have that bit of homework done knowing what their position of power is?
Absolutely. I think actually that's the biggest work that any brand builder really has to do, is help an organization or in certain cases individuals figure out what that is. We're so close to ourselves that we don't see it. And sometimes you need that person who's slightly outside of you to say, you know, this is the thing that you do really well. Because all of us have those things where we wish we were great at certain things. And what's fascinating about that is so often when we wish we were something other than we are, we completely miss the source of what makes us great. And that's organizations and individuals alike.
Well, and sometimes, especially at larger organizations that have been around for a long time, you have that mix of not knowing what the power or what, you know, what that positioning point is that gives them their power is, but you also have that clouded by things that you think are important, well, that ultimately don't matter, that kind of pivots back to what you mentioned in the earlier definition of branding, is that it's not just, especially today, it's not this one-way megaphone that we're shouting at people. It's what matters most in the hearts and minds of the community that you're trying to appeal to.
Exactly. I've long said that a brand exists in heads and hearts, not at headquarters. And I think it's one of the hardest lessons for organizations particularly to remember, that there is this thing that they want to be, and there's this thing that they think will be relevant, and then there's the thing that they are in the marketplace. And that's very often not the same thing. And my approach has always been to, when working with brands, say that's okay, because you exist for a reason. You have customers for a reason. They are supporting you for a reason. Articulate that reason, and then you will draw more of those people to you.
And how does that, you know, that's always a bit of detective work. You know, it's like when someone thinks they have a certain illness and there's actually some sort of other underlying condition, usually something like this. You know, what does that process look like? Because a lot of times I notice, you know, when you know, consulting with someone, you know, a lot of times, like you said, you do have customers. It's not the end of the world. I always say that the raw material's here, but where do you take it from there?
Well, your guest in tomorrow's recording will be even better on this for me. But for me, a brand often needs to start, that process starts in two places. One, where do you wish you were as a brand itself? Just absent anything else, absent your customers, what do you want to stand for? What are your values? What are your beliefs? what are the things that people would miss if you weren't there? Parallel to that is, okay, of the people who are interacting with you, what would they miss? What do they care about? Where does that intersect with the brand? And in that process, I hate to use an overused phrase here, but it's a bit art and it's a bit science. I mean, you've got to start with that understanding of what are the raw materials, as you say. But I think the really great brand builders are practiced synthesists in their ability to see patterns of what works well and what's going to resonate. But there's also there have been times when I've described the work that I do around brands as being kind of a human tuning fork. There are just things that over the years now, in one way or another, I've been building brands for really close to 20 years. There's just certain things that feel right and certain things that don't. And what I find for me, it's a back and forth process. I start with the research and see what that says, see what feels right to me, and then I go back and test that however I can. And it's back and forth until you find that refining process.
So specifically, you know, with some of that homework done, you know, your role now, why didn't you just describe, you know, Oradium and what you do a bit? Because I think it's fascinating, and I bet there's many that don't know and that would love to know more.
Well, Oradium is what I would call a messaging consultancy, and for me, it's the perfect place to be. When I worked in organizations and when I worked at brand strategy firms, we would always come up with these big statements of the brand, and here's what the brand stands for. And my experience, again, both at agencies and in organizations, was that great big brand almost always broke down in day-to-day conversations with customers, clients, supporters, et cetera. Meaning you can have a three-word thing. We're innovative and diverse and whatever. But you can't keep using those words every day. What do you say to people when you have to get out three blog posts a week and hundreds of status updates on Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn? You can't just keep saying we're innovative and diverse and all of this other stuff. It just doesn't work. So there's this blank space in the middle between a brand position, which is incredibly important, and day-to-day. And in that slot fits messaging. It is the translation of the brand into day-to-day language. And Oradium does that. We translate the brand into everyday language. So we do that in a couple ways. We work with our biggest piece of business is actually working with the sales teams of organizations and helping them figure out, okay, you've got a marketing department that set out their brand. You've got salespeople that need to go talk about the brand and product specifically. What do they say? What do they say that actually drives people to do the thing that you want them to do? And how do you do it in a way that supports the overall brand? We also do a lot of work with individual speakers and communicators in organizations to help them improve that overall ability to be able to speak on behalf of the brand extemporaneously, officially in keynotes or at annual meetings. I do a fair amount of the executive coaching with helping executives or organizations figure out, well, okay, what am I going to say at my annual remarks at this annual meeting? But we really solve that gap between that problem of how do you make sure that in these critical high-stakes conversations that happen every day for every organization, how do you make sure that they actually do the thing that you want them to do?
You know, it's funny. I was looking at my notes, and I had a question to ask, which is the role of speaking and oral communications in brand building. And damn it, you just answered that, too.
Well, ultimately, in any communication, written, I mean, the methodology that we use is just as useful for written communication as it is for spoken, which is part of why I love it. Ultimately, what I say I help people do is I help organizations and people, the people within them, learn to sell their ideas. And that's you always have to do that, no matter where you are, no matter what your status is in an organization, no matter whether you're in sales or not, you are always in a position of needing to get buy-in to an idea that you have. And maybe the idea is a product, but maybe the idea is an idea. Maybe it's support for something you need to have happen. Maybe it's to get a marketplace to endorse a change in direction. Ultimately, what you're trying to do is sell an idea. And if you think about it, no matter what your training is, most people have not had training in one or the other. Yeah. You know, so if you've had sales training, that's great. But most people haven't had any kind of training on the articulation of an idea. Marketing is really good at helping to get to that point of articulating an idea. But most marketers are terrible salespeople. And I will tell you that as a lifelong marketer.
Right.
But it's just it's really this interesting piece in between. And the role of spoken communication can be anywhere from what is the conversation that someone has with a customer on the phone, whether that's a outbound sales call or whether that's an executive of the organization giving a TED talk. All of those things impact people's understanding of the brand.
You know, you talk about it being, you know, marketers not having the sales training and everything else. And I also teach at the university here, and it's frighteningly nowhere to be found in curriculum either. This idea of, and it's just what you said, you're going to end up selling an idea at some point in your career in some form or another, internally or externally. And yeah, it's just an area where people need a lot of help, but it's incredibly important because it's a huge opportunity that if bungled, you know, really makes or breaks it.
Yeah, and I am a huge fan of restoring things like rhetoric, elocution, and oratory back to college curriculum and high school, actually. It's a funny thing that my high school, we had to give a speech, a persuasive speech, as a requirement for a graduation. And we all kind of poo-pooed it. But I will have to tell you, of all the things that high school made me do, that really set me on a course that was enormously useful, because I went to business school right after that, and I was one of the only people that had any kind of preparation in giving presentations. And what's fascinating about college and even high school these days is they hand you PowerPoint and they say, go make a presentation, but nobody tells you, even if they tell you how to use PowerPoint, they don't tell you how to build a communication to change an idea or change a belief or to drive an action. That's not taught. And I cannot imagine a more critical skill for anybody in any dimension of business or in life than understanding how to communicate effectively, persuasively, and well.
Yeah, I think it's our good mutual friend Mitch Joel who says, you may plug in a lot of stuff, but that doesn't make you an electrician. And I have to think that the other thing beyond people, brands not understanding their position of power, I'd say that you probably run into a lot of bad things done with PowerPoint in the name of air quotes, communication.
Yes. Well, we at Aratium have identified 6 fatal mistakes that most people tend to make. And they're not just what you would think. I mean, the surface structure is using bulleted PowerPoint with crazy amounts of text on screen. But the deeper problems that people run into are things like they tell the story from their perspective, which almost guarantees that it's not going to be relevant to your audience. They put way too much information in, which means that the audience can't process it. They put it in a completely random order so that it doesn't make any sense to the audience. The audience can't remember it. I mean, there's all these things that we do based on a combination of laziness, because we don't know any better, because of this low cultural bar, because we have natural instincts that, unfortunately, when it comes to communication, are pretty bad. Because our natural instinct is to tell the stories that make sense to us, that are relevant to us. But the thing is that everybody, audience included, your customers included, are also coming from that same, what we call sender-centric perspective, which means they only want to pay attention to things that make sense to them. So for you to be a good communicator, you have to flip that switch in your head and say, this is not about me. This is not about the story I want to tell. This is about them and what they need to hear, what's going to resonate for them, and what needs to be, how does that need to be told in a way that they are most likely to hear it and respond to it.
And I'd imagine that, you know, another aspect of that is a kind of cringe because it feels like a construct that marketers could abuse a bit. But we're really talking, too, about a better understanding of storytelling, which I think is a little bit lost, too.
It is. I hesitate a little bit with storytelling as one of my frustrations with the idea of storytelling, which has been around particularly in business communications for a while now, really started back when I did a lot of work around fundraising communication. So I spent a number of years with that as part of my job at a local performing arts college here in Boston. And then I spent 3 years doing it at Harvard Medical School. And what's so frustrating is they say, well, to get people to give money, tell stories. Well, from a practical standpoint, most people run into this idea of, which stories? Like, what story am I supposed to tell? Then there's the question of how do you tell the story? And then there's the question of why are you telling that story? What happens a lot and what people don't realize is that you tell stories, but the human brain is very bad at pulling the moral of the story out. You know, there's a reason why Aesop at the end of the fable would say the moral of the story is, which is basically, in case you missed the point, everybody, here's the point. But the vast majority of business storytellers miss the point. They miss telling people, here's the point. And so, yeah, storytelling has a structure, it has a purpose, and it absolutely is a lost, almost lost art. And I think people just feel like if I just tell a story, then I'm storytelling. I would argue that that's very far from the case.
You know, it's funny because when I brought up storytelling, if you could see me, I was making kind of the, I said an icky word face. it's got some baggage with it, but I think, like you said, it's the forgetting things like, Aesop actually unpacking the actual moral of the story instead of just kind of wandering off into a corn maze. our first guest here on Brand was Patrick Hanlon, who wrote the book Primal Branding, where he breaks down the various elements of what he calls primal code that all brands have. And one of those is a creation story, you know, that we know where all great brands came from. And I believe it's in that book where he tells a story about Sherwood Schwartz, creator of Brady Bunch, Gilligan's Island. Someone asked him one time why all of the theme songs to his shows really just kind of laid out the whole premise for the show when everybody's already seen it. Or so they think.
Yeah.
And he said it's because someone watching it for the first time might not know that. And I thought that was kind of brilliant and you know, someone that really understood things from the audience's perspective as well.
Yeah, think about it from the perspective of websites. The data is so clear that the vast majority of visitors to websites are first-time visitors. But if you really dive deep into how how most websites are built and what level of language and what level of assumptions the copy has in it, they're not written for first-time visitors. Because, I mean, think about most websites. They're written on our products, our services, about us, our history, and where does a customer see themselves? Most companies do not start with, you have this problem, we solve this problem. It's let's tell us your products. Well, who cares about your products until they actually know whether or not you're relevant at all? And you can't do that unless you've established what the problem is. So, I mean, that goes back to storytelling. Any good storytelling has a conflict. But most marketers, I would say even salespeople, forget that you have to establish that conflict first. Here's your problem.
Yeah.
And, okay, now that you have that problem, then you want to spend some time on it's – this is not good that you have this problem. This problem is actually having this problem is really, really bad. And the thing that I'm asking you to do, or the thing that might solve it for you, that that pain of change is far less than the pain of your status quo. But just think about websites. We don't do that.
I had not till you brought it up. And I would have to think that when you're working with clients on what might be a very focused engagement on, you know, focused on communications, on, you know, sales team, sales presentations, I'd have to think that some of those same light bulbs might be going off. They're like, oh my gosh, our whole website's wrong.
Yep. All the time. Yeah. I mean, most of our engagements start with a day or a day and a half workshop, basically to lay the groundwork of why are communications important? Why do we struggle for impact? What are the mistakes that we make? Why do we make them? And then this process and methodology for really being able to build in a repeatable way communications that work over and over again. And we say at the end of this workshop that nobody is sadder in those workshops than the person who has a presentation to give in 2 days. Because they've already done, well, let's assume they're not doing it on the plane on their way there, but they've probably done all the work to build it. And then there's this thing where they're like, oh my goodness, it's completely wrong. But the good news is that we've had stories of clients who, after that workshop, we had a major financial wealth management bank, national bank, was a client of ours, and they went through the workshop on a Tuesday, and on a Thursday they had a presentation to a prospective client that they had pitched to basically two previous times. And after the first day, they decided to just go blow up the presentation, put it back together. And they did. And they got it back together in time. And they won. They won a $2 million contract after they had failed two previous times. So it's one of those things where we say, yeah, it's awful when you're realizing there's all these things that you're doing wrong and you didn't realize it. But the satisfying thing is that there's concrete ways to fix it. And once you know it, you can't unknow it. And that's enormously empowering.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it can totally feel like it's a huge mountain of work, but I think seeing what the path is, even if the work's not done, is, I think, even more than half the battle, because some can't even see that.
Yeah. It's, knowledge is power. But yes. It absolutely is. And I'm a process girl at heart. I love having a process for things. And when I first was exposed to the methodology of my company, the thing that I said to myself was, oh, this is now a thing I can do every time that codifies what I had been doing by and large intuitively that I had figured out and picked up over the years. I mean, you don't spend 13 years as a Weight Watcher leader without figuring out how to get people to change their mind in a short period of time. But you don't necessarily realize what you're doing in order to do that. Yeah. And this was just a really, all of a sudden I was like, oh, this is why. Oh, this makes sense. Yay. Okay. Now I can do this for whatever I need going forward.
You know, that's the other thing. We you know, kind of covered the fun fact, but I love how all of these different things, even from outside of the realm, I mean, I joke that I spend more time in the College of Business right now than I ever did when I was at school. But all these other experiences, whether that's, being a Weight Watchers leader or, for me, it's the background in theater arts and improv. So it's like, you know, there's all of these strategies that, you know, impact all of these other things too. Like we always talked in improv about starting scenes in the middle, like getting rid of all the exposition.
Which is a super way to tell a story, by the way, and the mistake a lot of businesses make. So I just keep talking about that, but that's one of my favorite things about storytelling. It's just like, don't tell a complete story. And nonprofits do it all the time.
Well, and you think of all of these great examples of it too. Like if you think about, it's getting hard to segment, all of the different sprawling pieces of the Star Wars franchise. But when Star Wars started, the Star Wars in 1977 was Episode 4, you know. And at the time, he kind of ruined that. But at the time, you know, he didn't bother with Episodes 1 through 3. And that's why they weren't as awesome.
Yeah. Well, I completely agree. And the thing about a story that's complete is that the audience, the hearer, has no role in it.
Yeah.
They can be empathic to it, but they can't be an actor in it. And think about branding. You need people to be an actor. Think about fundraising. You need people to be an actor in that. But if you just tell a story of, here was a successful case that we did.
Yeah.
The person's going, well, that's nice, but you just talked about a pharma company and I'm an oil refinery. So what is the heck that, what does that have to do with me? So I think that's one of the key things, not only storytelling with branding, is that you have to leave a space in your brand for your customer. They have to see where they fit.
You know, I want to pivot just a little bit and talk about another formidable brand in your life, and that is the TEDx Cambridge event that you produce. But also I think of, you know, that's, you know, I was, wanted to talk about that, but then in a branding context, I think you have, you know, the huge entity that is TED, and then you have these TEDx events. And they've maintained an incredible amount, because for those that don't know, the TEDx events are independently organized. You can probably speak to it better than I can, but there's an amazing amount of brand consistency between all of that. Can you take us inside that a bit? And
sure. I think that happens primarily from two ways. First is that the organizers of TEDx events are believe very passionately in the overall mission of TED. So there's this inherent desire to sustain the TED-like experience at these individual events. The second thing is that the main TED organization is actually quite prescriptive in how those events go. I mean, different events can take different approaches. TEDx Cambridge, for instance, is the only one that I know of that really treats it as a premium evening event. So a lot of TEDx events do day-long our weekend-long events with 20, 30, 40 speakers. We have six. We do six speakers twice a year. And so that for us, that's fairly different. But the format, you know, the way that visuals are handled is strongly recommended by TEDx Cambridge, by TED. The opening is always the same. The graphics are expected to follow a certain pattern. And the license process, which the executive director could speak to better than I, is a yearly renewal thing. So you have to have lived up to TED's expectations in order to continue to be able to organize those local events.
Yeah. So, and you've been doing that for, have you done?
I've done it for, two events and two more coming up next year.
Very cool. Two.
We do two a year because we only have six talks. We do it twice so that we have a May, late spring, early summer representation, and then a late fall. So late September, or I guess late summer, early fall.
Is that unique in the among the TEDx doing two?
If it's not unique, it's certainly rare. Yeah. Again, we. The vision of our executive director is to have a very much a premier event. His vision, and I share it because it sounds like a fun thing to produce, mm-hmm. is that he wants people who come to TEDx Cambridge to feel like they came to East Coast TED, even if it's only one block of content. So that means we try very hard to get speakers at a certain level so that it's a, as you can tell, with six talks, it's a tightly curated event. They are heavily coached. That is also unusual for TEDx events. I work with the speakers for 12 to 16 weeks, from everything from talk design all the way through to delivery. So we build the talk from the ground up together. And we have a spectacular reception every time afterwards as well, featuring all the best restaurants of Cambridge and Boston. And it's a fun event, but we really work hard to make sure it's a very, very high end event as well.
Very cool. Well, you know, speaking of speaking, you talked about coaching the speakers, and obviously you're a great speaker yourself. And I think I have this right. It was at New Media Expo, NMX 2013, you talked about brand advocates and influencer outreach. And I believe the clever title of that would compel any audience member that they would have to learn more, was Glasses, a Love Story.
Yeah, I think it might have been 2012 because last year's NMX talk was about zombies.
Zombies and glasses.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But yes, I think it was 2012. It was Glasses, a Love Story. My continuing love affair with Warby Parker and using them as a case study to illustrate a model that I had kind of observed in my work as a social and content strategist in agencies. So how kind of different types of advocates. There's this tendency, I think, for brands to think that there's either the media outlets or there's these passionate brand advocates that have blogs and huge followings and whatever. And ultimately, my perspective on it was that the most passionate followers can have the biggest effect, even if their platform isn't large, because the depth of their passion and their focus on it is incredibly powerful for the people in their small circle. And oftentimes those people have very powerful people in their immediate circle after them. And so basically it was an argument for understanding that it's not so black and white, and there's a much wider range of advocates out there, and that you should respond to those people differently and you should cultivate them differently.
Well, and you had, I believe, like four quadrants of types of advocates. I think you'd sent me that slide somewhere. I'll try to embed that again on the show notes. But I think there was the big media.
Yep, that's the kind of catalytic connector, if I remember correctly. So this kind of the person who, if they talk about you in a media, usually in a media environment, just vaults your brand. So think about when Oprah used to do her favorite things episode, or book clubs, anytime she mentioned something, it just went boom even it came out of nowhere, was just suddenly sold out and everywhere. And then there was the passionate publishers, which were the bloggers and the journalists and the people who wrote regularly on a topic, that they were deep subject matter experts. Not necessarily the kind of people that you would engage with and whose articles and blogs you would read kind of in preparation for making a decision, but usually you wouldn't read one of the, you know, a publisher's thing and say, oh, I'm totally going to make that choice. Then there was the I don't remember all my qualifiers at this point, but the everyday advocates who were just kind of the people who just chat about the brand and say, hey, I love it. And, you know, not a huge base of support. But the people that I think are the unsung heroes of brand advocacy are what I call the activators. They're the ones that drive people to action always, whether their circle of influence is large or small. The degree of influence is very, very high.
Yeah, because I mean, I think that was, you know, one of the big takeaways too, especially if you talk about, you know, what's our influencer strategy, or, you know, it's something that we get homogenous about it, and we think about, you know, just the, you know, the big names, the Robert Scobles, the how we're going to, and there's this other level that you can aim for that you can actually, you know, see a lot of impact on.
Well, I think there's always benefit in constraining your thinking, and that sounds strange, but at the same time, largely, I think constraints breed creativity. But when it comes particularly to branding and messaging, and this is something I'm fairly passionate about, I think a mistake that a lot of brands make is that they need everything to be this big same message, and the only place where that overall brand message needs to make cohesive sense is the brand itself. And I think brands would get so much further, so much faster, if they would really, really focus on saying, this is the group of people that we want, and we are going to talk to them specifically in this way. And frankly, be willing to say, we're not going to talk to everybody, and we're not going to see the whole market as our market. Well, just think about it this way. It's an exercise that I do when I'm working with organizations on their sales messaging. So whenever you're developing a sales messaging, you're saying, well, it's for this particular product, and let's say it's this stage in the buying cycle, and it's for this customer segment. Okay, that's fine. You know, you've got to, now you know it's an early stage meeting. It's for this particular product. But then you get into something where people will say, well, we're going to go for, you know, our client, the customer that we want to talk to is we really want to go for this, you know, mid-size multinational organization. And I say, well, that's great. But when you're trying to do something like articulate the problem that you solve for them, then that's very hard because there could be a whole bunch of different problems. But the more that you say, pick a company, which one do you want? That all of a sudden, the minute you pick a company, everything else locks in. Well, they're dealing with this particular problem, and this is the way this thing would solve them. So you know what? Develop that message. And while at the front end, that sounds scary because you say, well, how could that be applicable to everybody else? You'd be amazed at how applicable it truly is to everybody else. And whether that's sales messaging or branding, I think the same thing applies, is that the more specific you can get in your head about who are you talking to, the better that message will be. And therefore, the higher the probability that the communication will have the result that you want it to have.
Awesome. And again, as you mentioned, you know, Warby Parker does a great job of outreach to those activators and influencers throughout. As we start to wrap up, you know, I'm a huge Warby Parker fan as well, and it's they've just done such a great job of crafting their entire experience. Are there other brands lately that are making you smile?
Oh, well, it's no secret that my equal favorite brand, and probably the one that is that wins my heart even more right now, is Diane von Furstenberg, who I just think is just nailing it on all cylinders, from not only from brand articulation, but all the way through to digital social content, how they use channels, how they're using mass media now. They just wrapped a reality show about House of DVF. And it's a brand I've been watching really since the Warby Parker first took my attention. I mean, I've loved DVF and the DVF style for a long time, but as a brand, I've been watching them for about five, six years now, and they are just an absolute textbook case study in how to do it right.
So I was going to say, what touch point of theirs surprised you most, but maybe it was the reality show, or is there another?
Well, I think the reality show is one. I can see where that's heading, but they are this year particularly, it's the 40th anniversary of Diane's signature dress, the wrap dress. And so this year was a full court press. I mean, they released two books. They did an exhibition in LA of the dresses. So I think that was fairly unexpected. They basically said, this is a design object, so let's create an exhibition of design. And I think that's a fascinating thing. I mean, think about some other brand. I mean, Apple could do it. Any number of other brands could do it. Like, let's create an exhibition of just our stuff, highlighting where the evolution of design is. I think that says enormous amount about the brand. But I think the thing that I'm always charmed by is to find these unexpected places where they show up right at the edge of where other people are. So 4 years ago, I might have the timing wrong on this, but 3 years ago, they were on Viddy before anybody else was. They were the first brand that I ever saw on Songza, and this was before Songza started actively reaching out for brands, as far as I know. So they had like a yoga one, and they said, hey, there was a playlist for getting ready to go out at night, and I just stumbled across these things. But that's part of how I started noticing the brand, was that I was starting to see them in these unusual places. And don't forget too that the public debut of Google Glass was on a runway show for Diane von Furstenberg.
I did not know that, but that seems, after you laid out all of that, that seems very smart for both parties.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Google Glass, maybe not as successful these days as
right,
DVF is.
Right. But I see where her head was at.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, I am continually impressed with the experimentation, and it's on brand experimentation. And I just think that's great. And you add to that the very human touches that occur, it's very possible that if you interact with the DVF brand enough, that you will get a tweet back from Diane herself. You know, there's cool things like that. And on their website, I mean, their email marketing is second to none, by the way. But they'll do very cool things. Like, she wrote a book this year. On the website, you, as an email subscriber, you had early access to get a signed copy of the book. And who does that? It's just really, really smart, very clever thing. So yeah, DVF is my favorite case study right now for just about everything. And I love her dresses.
And that always helps too. Well, Tamsin, where can folks go? Where's the best place online to learn more about you and what you do?
The best place to get the day-to-day stuff is oratium.com. We will be launching an actual blog here next year at some point, so that's good. Otherwise, I'm starting to be more active again on Twitter. I'm always fairly active on Facebook, and you can also find me on LinkedIn. So Tamsin Webster, I'm Tamadeer on Twitter.
Awesome. Well, we will link up to all of that. Tamsin, thank you for being on brand with us.
Well, thank you, Nick, for having me.
Before we head out, I also want to give a big thanks to a mentor of this podcast and a mutual friend of both Tamsin and myself. That's Jay Baer over at Convince and Convert. In addition to being a digital marketing thought leader, speaker, and best-selling author, he's created a new online resource indexing all of the great marketing podcasts out there. It's called Marketing Podcasts, and you can find it at marketingpodcasts.com. If you like marketing, if you like podcasts, you should check it out. And some final reminders, as I indicated, show notes and links will be at branddrivendigital.com. You can also subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, and RSS. Speaking of iTunes, podcasters live and die by those ratings and reviews. Head over there and give this show a quick rating, drop in a couple of sentences, and tell us what you think. Help others find the show. And don't forget that this podcast is brought to you by the Brand Driven Digital Event Series. Learn more about Twitter Brand Basics, Digital Strategy Bootcamp, and the industry-leading Social Brand Forum at branddrivendigital.com. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.